The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Religion News Service and the Associated Press. Our first article was published on the 1st of March, written by Yonat Shimron, entitled, "For many congregations, wiping out medical debt has become a popular calling." Durham, North Carolina. When members of First Presbyterian Church decided to launch a capital campaign to expand and renovate their imposing Gothic Revival edifice, they also wanted to take on a service project to help the poor. The congregation settled on raising $50,000 to eliminate medical debt for people living below the poverty line. Helping ease medical debt, especially for people of color, is an increasingly popular social justice project among liberal Christian, Jewish, and Muslim congregations. Over the past few years, some 800 U.S. congregations have partnered with RIP Medical Debt to do so. The 9-year-old nonprofit uses donations to buy large bundle portfolios of medical debt from collection agencies and other third parties at a steep discount. It then turns around and notifies people their debts have been erased. For churches seeking to make a difference for those suffering under the weight of debt, this is an instrument we can use to take it off their shoulders so that everyone can flourish, said the Reverend Mindy Douglas, pastor of First Presbyterian. Last year, the church was able to raise almost $26,000 and pay off $5 million in medical debt in Durham and surrounding counties. This spring, the church will kick off the second leg of its campaign with the goal of raising at least $25,000 more. Eliminating medical debt has become a popular cause over the past few years. Georgia Democrat Stacey Abrams donated $1.34 million to RIP through her political action committee, wiping out $212 million in medical debt for 108,000 people in five states. Hawks Point guard Trey Young and football wide receiver Michael Thomas have also donated to RIP. Last year, philanthropist Mackenzie Scott added $30 million to the $50 million she donated to RIP in 2020, jump-starting the nonprofit's expansion. Medical debt is a huge problem in the U.S. Americans owe at least $195 billion of medical debt, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. More than 100 million people, about 41% of U.S. adults, have debt from medical or dental bills. Among Black and Hispanic Americans, that figure jumps to about 60%. RIP's model of buying debt at discounted prices is especially attractive to donors because, on average, every $1 donated abolishes about $100 in face value medical debt. To date, RIP has abolished $8.5 billion in medical debt and relieved 5.4 million Americans of their unpaid bills. While donations from religious groups constitute less than 20% of RIP's overall revenue, they have become an increasingly common way for congregations to engage in social justice work. One reason may be that debt relief has deep biblical resonance. The book of Leviticus speaks of the Jubilee year as a time when the people of Israel were required to free slaves and cancel debts. It's a wonderful way to take ancient biblical values and actualize them, said Rabbi Ari Hart, whose Agadath Jacob Synagogue in Skokie, Illinois, partnered with two predominantly Black churches in Chicago to raise $10,000 for medical debt relief last year. RIP used the money to purchase $1.9 million in debt and unburden 2,327 people in the Chicago area. The campaign also coincided with the Jewish sabbatical year, known as the Shemitah, or the Year of Release. Hart said he would propose a similar campaign during the next Jewish sabbatical year, which falls in 2028. The Mid-Michigan campaign, started by St. John's Episcopal Church in Midland, Michigan, is another interfaith venture. Last year, it raised $62,452 to abolish $28 million worth of medical debt among 14,241 individuals. This year, it has launched another campaign with the Mid-Midland Interfaith Friends, a group of 14 congregations, including Jewish, Muslim, and Baha'i. "It's love in action," said Reverend Jim Harrison, priest in charge at St. John's Episcopal Church, which has committed $20,000 from the church's endowment income toward this year's fundraiser. Harrison acknowledged raising money for medical debt relief won't solve the larger structural issues created by a healthcare system Americans can't afford. The United States has the most expensive healthcare system of any country. But it can bring relief. This is treating a symptom, not a cause, but it's something we can do, and I think we need to, Harrison said. For many congregations, such as First Presbyterian, debt relief is also a form of reparation. In 2021, the Durham Church began studying about reparations. Congregants read, "From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century," and discussed ways they could get involved with William A. Darity Jr. and A. Kirsten Mullen, the book's authors. The service project with RIP was one of the outcomes of the reparations study. The church explicitly targeted North Carolina counties with a Black or Indigenous population of 50% or more for debt relief. "We see disproportionate outcomes in our health care system for people of color," said Sharon Hirsch, a member of First Presbyterian who serves on the church's Racial Equality Task Force. A 2022 Urban Institute study found that counties with high shares of uninsured, low-income, or Black populations have higher rates of medical debt. Southern states that have not expanded Medicaid eligibility for low-income Americans were more likely to have high levels of medical debt. Helping those counties address that debt is one area where the church could make systemic change, Hirsch said. "I just don't know any other example where your money can go that far and have such a positive impact on an individual," Hirsch said. "This is targeted relief that will reduce economic stress and support families in need of economic relief." Now an article from the Associated Press that was published on the 1st of March, entitled "A Time Bomb, India's Sinking Holy Town Faces Grim Future," by Shonal Gargarli and Krutika Pathy. Joe Shemuth. Inside a shrine overlooking snow-capped mountains, Hindu priest heaps spoonfuls of puffed rice and ghee into a crackling fire. They closed their eyes and chanted, hoping their prayers would somehow turn back time and save their holy and sinking town. For months, the roughly 20,000 residents in Joshimath, which is burrowed in the Himalayas and revered by Hindu and Sikh pilgrims, have watched the earth slowly swallow their community. They pleaded for help that never arrived, and in January, their desperate plight made it into the international spotlight. But by then, Joshimath was already a disaster zone. Multi-storied hotels slumped to one side, cracked roads gaped open. More than 860 homes were uninhabitable, splayed by deep fissures. And instead of saviors, they got bulldozers that razed swaths of the town. The holy town was built on piles of debris left behind by landslides and earthquakes. Scientists have warned for decades that Joshimath could not withstand the level of heavy construction that has recently been taking place. Cracks are widening every day and people are in fear. It's a time bomb, said Atul Sadi, an activist with the Save Joshimath Committee. Joshimath's future is at risk, experts and activists say, due in part to a push backed by the Prime Minister's political party to grow religious tourism in Uttarakhand, the holy town's home state. On top of climate change, extensive new construction to accommodate more tourists and accelerate hydropower projects in the region is exacerbating subsistence, the sinking of land. Joshimath is said to have special spiritual powers and believed to be where Hindu guru Adi Shankaracharya found enlightenment in the 8th century before going on to establish 4 monasteries across India, including one in Joshimath. Visitors pass through the town on their way to the famous Sikh shrine Hemkund Sahib and the Hindu temple Badrinath. It must be protected, a local priest who called the Joshimath the brain of North India explained, that our one body can still function if limbs are cut off, but if anything happens to our brain, we can't function. Its survival is extremely important. The town's loose topsoil and soft rocks can only support so much, and that limit, according to environmentalist Vimlendu Jha, may have already been breached. In the short term, you might think it's development, but in the long term, it is actually devastation, he said. At least 240 families have been forced to relocate without knowing if they would be able to return. Prabha Sadi, who fled Joshimath last month when our home began to crack and tilt, came back to grab her belongings before state officials demolished her home. Now I will have to leave everything behind. Every little piece of it will be destroyed, she said, blinking back tears. Authorities, ignoring expert warnings, have continued to develop costly projects in the region, including a slew of hydropower substations and a lengthy highway. The latter is aimed at further boosting religious tourism, a key plank of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party. Uttarakhand, dotted with several holy shrines, would see a surge in tourists in the next decade thanks to improved infrastructure, Modi said in 2021. Nearly 500,000 passed through Joshimath in 2019, state data shows. A big draw is the Char Dham pilgrimage, where pilgrims traverse challenging terrain and harsh weather to reach 4 high-altitude temples. In 2022, 200 out of the 250,000 pilgrims died while making the journey. Authorities said the rise in visitors was straining existing infrastructure. Already underway, the Char Dham infrastructure project aims to make the journey more accessible via a long and wide all-weather highway and railway line that would crisscross through the mountains. Some experts fear the project will exacerbate the fragile situation in the Himalayas, where several towns are built atop debris. To create such wide roads, engineers would need to smash boulders, cut trees, and strip shrubbery, which would weaken slopes and make them more susceptible to natural disaster, said veteran environmentalist Ravi Chopra. While construction for the project near Joshimath was paused last month, locals fear it was too late. A long crack running across one of the front walls in the famed Adi Shankaracharya monastery had developed worryingly in recent weeks, said Vishnu Priyanan, one of the priests. Let places of worship remain as places of worship. Don't make them tourist spots, he pleaded. It's not just the highways. In late January, hundreds of residents protested against the National Thermal Power Corporation's Tapovan hydropower station located near Joshimath. Our town is on the very verge of destruction because of this project, said Atul Sadi, the Save Joshimath committee member. Locals say construction blasts for a 12-kilometer tunnel for the station are causing homes to crumble. Work has been suspended, but NTPC officials deny any link to Joshimath subsidence. Various government agencies were conducting surveys to determine what caused the damage, and Himanshu Kirirana, the officer in charge of Chamoli District, where Joshimath is located. The crisis has reignited questions over whether India's quest for more hydropower in the mountains to cut its reliance on coal can be achieved sustainably. Uttarakhand has around 100 hydropower projects in varying stages. The heavy construction required for hydropower could do irreparable damage in a region already vulnerable to climate change, experts warn. It could also displace entire villages, as residents of a one near Joshimath found out. Hutt, along the Alaknanda River, was once a sacred hamlet where the guru Adi Shankarachara is said to have established another temple in the 8th century. Today, it is a dumping site for waste and a storage pit for construction materials, after the village was acquired in 2009 by an energy enterprise to build a hydropower project. The Lakshmi Narayan Temple is the only part of the village still standing. All of its residents were relocated, and Rajendra Hatal, once the village chief, who now lives in another town, said. Hatwal and a few others still check in on the temple. A caretaker who refused to leave lives in a makeshift room next to it. He sweeps the grounds, cleans the idols, and prepares tea for the odd guest who comes through. They fear its days are numbered. We are fighting to protect the village and the temple. We want to preserve our ancient culture to pass on to a new generation, said Hatwal. They have not only destroyed a village, they have finished a 1,200-year-old culture. Now a piece written by Lori Amber Rosner for the Religion News Service. She is a professor in the School of Journalism and Electronic Media at the University of Tennessee. Entitled, How Jimmy Carter Integrated His Evangelical Christian Faith into His Political Work, Despite Mockery and Misunderstanding. I am a farmer, an engineer, a businessman, a planner, a scientist, a governor, and a Christian, Jimmy Carter said, describing himself to a National Political Report event when he announced his campaign to be the 39th president of the United States in December 1974. As journalists and historians consider Carter's legacy, this prelude to Carter's campaign offers insight into how he wanted to be known and how he liked to be remembered. After studying Carter's presidential campaign, presidency, and post-presidency for years, which included examining more than 25,000 archival documents, media sources, oral histories, and interviews, I wrote Jimmy Carter and the Birth of the Marathon Media Campaign. Along the way, I had the opportunity to interview former President Carter in October 2014, at what time we discussed his life, his presidency, and his legacy. Based upon this experience, one observation is certain. Carter was a man of faith committed to a vision of the nation that aligned with his views of Jesus' teachings. A campaign cloaked in a message of love and justice. In the fall of 1975, after his initial announcement failed to elicit much national attention for his candidacy, the still relatively unknown Georgia governor published the campaign biography, Why Not the Best? Within the book, he told the story of his wholesome childhood on his family's peanut farm in Archery, Georgia, and of achieving his childhood dream through his appointment to the Naval Academy in 1943. He wrote of his dedication to his family as a loyal son, husband, and father, and his duty-bound career transition to manage his family-owned peanut farm, warehouse, and store after his father Earl Carter's premature death from pancreatic cancer in 1953. He also shared his lifelong commitment to community and public service. Moreover, he offered himself as a public servant who could bridge the chasm between the American people and the government that had emerged after the revelations of presidential corruption amid Vietnam and Watergate. Our government can and must represent the best and highest ideals of those of us who can voluntarily submit to its authority. In our third century, we must meet these simple but crucial standards, he wrote in the campaign biography. Though Carter cloaked his campaign in Jesus' teachings about love and justice, most national reporters did not give Carter's faith much attention until he became the Democratic Party's frontrunner in advance of the North Carolina primary in 1976. Lust in my heart. When national reporters finally turned their attention to his faith, what campaign director Hamilton Jordan referred to as Carter's weirdo factor, the evangelical politician acknowledged that he had spent more time on my knees in the 4 years I was governor than I did in all the rest of my life. Carter continued to share his understanding of the gospel with journalists and their audiences in a plain-spoken manner, even though it was not always advantageous to his political fortunes. For instance, after continued probes about his faith that summer from Playboy magazine correspondent Robert Shear, Carter launched into a sermon on pride, lust, and lying that would haunt him later. I try not to commit a deliberate sin. I recognize that I'm going to do it anyhow because I'm human and I'm tempted. I've looked on a lot of women with lust. Carter, believing he was off the record, said in attempting to clarify his religious views, I've committed adultery in my heart many times. Carter referred to Matthew 5:28, the biblical passage in which Jesus shares this interpretation of the seventh commandment with the words, But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Uninterrupted, Carter continued his salty explanation of the verse. Christ doesn't say, consider yourself better than someone else because one guy screws a whole bunch of women while the other guy is loyal to his wife. We have heard Jesus' words all our lives, ever since we were 3-4 years old, and we knew what it meant, Carter later explained. But obviously the general public, when I said, lust in my heart, that was a top headline. It looked like I spent my time trying to seduce other women. Rosalind knew that wasn't true. Though Carter's comments were on a solid theological ground, according to many people of faith, up-and-coming leaders of the religious right, such as televangelist Jerry Falwell, castigated Carter. And in the end, many folks agreed with the well-regarded columnist Mary McGrory. The interview should have been an off-the-record conversation with God, not one taped by Playboy. Crisis of confidence. Despite the erosion of support among the emerging religious right after the Playboy gaffe, Carter remained steadfast in his commitment to his Christian values and a faith-inspired vision for the nation that advanced human rights at home and abroad. He called it a new beginning. Carter beseeched his American brethren to chart a new course during his inaugural address in January 1977. Our commitment to human rights must be absolute, our laws fair, our natural beauty preserved. The powerful must not persecute the weak, and human dignity must be enhanced. Carter had achieved what Time magazine hailed as one of the most astonishing political miracles in the nation's history because of his rapid ascension from a virtual virtually unknown politician, to the presidency. But many citizens suffering from an emerging crisis of confidence in the American dream and faith in its institutions and leaders had already begun to tune out Carter's political sermons about the looming energy crisis, stagflation, and international conflicts. Moreover, in the coming years, they would become indignant toward the man who had condemned the corruption of his predecessors and promised to never tell a lie on the campaign trail, yet remain loyal to one of his oldest advisors, the Office of Management and Budget Director, Burt Lantz, who was accused of unethical banking practices. Long-lasting commitment to public service. In the end, Carter stood accused of failing to live up to his campaign promises from the vantage point of many American citizens amid domestic crises and foreign conflict. Nevertheless, Carter remained committed to his religious convictions. I have spoken many times of love, but love must be aggressively translated into simple justice, he invoked his audience when he accepted the Democratic nomination in July 1976. For the remainder of his life, he has attempted to model the translation of Jesus' love into action through his life of public service. His post-presidential commitments involved the Carter Center's initiatives of fighting disease and seeking international peace, and his private efforts of building homes for Habitat for Humanity and teaching Sunday school. In the end, Carter will leave this world with only one acknowledged regret. I wish I'd sent one more helicopter to get the hostages, and we would have rescued them, and I would have been reelected, he said, referring to the April 1980 military rescue attempt of the 53 U.S. hostages held by Iranian revolutionaries. In Carter's final days, his words from his presidential farewell address, which remain true today, are worth remembering. The battle for human rights at home and abroad is far from over. If we are to serve as a beacon for human rights, we must continue to perfect here at home the rights and values which we espouse around the world. A decent education for our children, adequate medical care for all Americans, an end to discrimination against minorities and women, a job for all those able to work, and freedom from injustice and religious intolerance. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.